The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome along to another week of The Greg Hughes Show here in Highland Radio. It's just turned 4 minutes past nine on this Monday, the 22nd of June, 2026. We're here with you, of course, with for the next 2 hours to keep you across all the major breaking news stories from around the world and close at home as well. And of course, we're going to have to focus on the awfully tragic events. There are no words. Tragic is the word that we sort of say, isn't it? But I think we've all been moved by the terrible passing of young Tadhg. He died whilst watching the Donegal International Rally. Tadhg Callaghan Carter. We've just learned of the funeral arrangements for young Tadhg. We'll be talking about that. But I suppose at this juncture, you know, when you start off a programme like this and you try and set the mood for it, what can you say other than to say that I'm sure everyone who heard that news, you feel it personally, don't you? We all, Tadhg is the same as our sons, the same as our nephews, the same as our school friends. You know, Tadhg, looking at him, he just embodies everything that we all love and cherish in our own families. And I cannot imagine what his family, his loving family, must be going through today. I can't imagine what his friends are going through today, and everyone that knew him, be it through sport or be it through school. I can't imagine what the driver of the car that was involved in this accident is going through, and the co-driver in that car. The people who were the first responders, those that were transporting Tadhg to hospital, everyone touched by it. It's such a huge ripple of impact. But ultimately, the incredibly sad news is a young man with the world at his feet and his life ahead of him taken so suddenly. There must be a reason. There must be a point. There must be a greater plan if you believe in religion or God or whatever way you want to phrase it. There must be a bigger plan. What else? Because it's inexplicable, isn't it? And on the Monday after a rally, normally we're talking about, you know, the event. You know, maybe sometimes there can be a crash here or there, but very rarely is there a fatality, either on the course or for those watching. And it's 2012 since the last spectator death watching a Motorsport Ireland event happened. But yet here we are. That doesn't matter, does it? Because we're here today having to deal with what we're having to deal with. And we'll talk about it a little later on to get an understanding of Tadhg. We'll speak to his school. Of course, the Gardaí have a role to play here in Motorsport Ireland as well. But in our first instance, it is to pass on our love, our thoughts, prayers and strength to all of those that need it the most at this time following the sad passing of young Tadhg. And we'll start with the Donegal news. Tributes have been paid to the teenaged boy who died in a tragic collision at the Donegal International Rally on Saturday. 15-year-old Tadhg Carter was the young man who passed away. I'm just skipping over here. They're talking of funeral arrangements confirmed, but we do have those. Prayers were said at Masses on Sunday at St. Columbkill's Church in Glendone and in surrounding parishes following Saturday's tragedy. A post-mortem examination is to be carried out at Letterkenny University Hospital this morning, which would be standard practice in a sudden death scenario. But we're told Tadhg suffered fatal injuries in an incident while spectating at Special Stage 12 at Garton. Two other spectators were brought to hospital on Saturday to receive treatment for injuries described as non-life-threatening. Motorsport Ireland and Donegal Motor Club then released a joint statement, obviously reflecting on the awful events. And we'll have words from them a little bit later on. The Derry news this morning. Sinn Féin has launched its assembly and local government, Derry City and Strabane District Council election campaign. Uniquely, both elections are scheduled to take place. That's Foyle and Derry City and Strabane. Both are due to take place on the same day, Thursday, May 6th. On to the Nationals now. And Keir Starmer's number is up, it would say, politically. It seems like he'll outline his departure, unless something changes significantly. But the Irish Times reports, it's their top story, that embattled Prime Minister Keir Starmer is expected to announce a timetable for his departure imminently, putting the UK on course for its seventh premier in a decade. It's understood that Starmer will set out his intentions outside 10 Downing Street, potentially as early as today. The move would clear the way for Andy Burnham to become Prime Minister by the autumn and without a formal contest. It would get very messy if Starmer were to try and stick it out. It'd get very messy for him, so maybe he can go out on his shield now. The expected announcement follows a thumping victory by Burnham, the former mayor of Greater Manchester, in last week's Wakefield by-election near Wigan. So he would have been seen as a person for the future to leave to lead Keir Starmer. But you have to be a member of Parliament to be the leader, obviously, to be the Prime Minister. So he had to go and parachute himself in to some extent to a by-election, get elected, and then come down to London to challenge Starmer. And so here we are. The Irish Daily Mail, and workers will be able to earn up to €1,000 a week before they pay the 40% top rate of tax onto new plans. Budget 27 will be the first step of a grand strategy by Taoiseach and Minister for Finance Simon Harris, who's on the hunt for a legacy, one minister said. As pre-budget speculation accelerates, Fine Gael leader Mr Harris has remained coy over his key plans, but sources within the party confirmed he's made it very clear to the party that his primary intention is to ensure no one earning less than £1,000 a week will pay the higher rate of tax. So I'm not sure how many within Donegal at the moment, say for instance, or in this region, would be paying the higher rate of tax. Not as many as in other parts of the world, it has to be said. And I suppose a move like this would take more people from Donegal in this region, and generally speaking, counties that are less well off, would take them out of the highest pay bracket for tax, that is. Currently, single taxpayers enter the higher rate of tax band once they earn more than €44,000, just below the current average salary of €44,200, and raising it to £1,000 a week would amount to €52,000 a year. You'd still be paying tax, but you wouldn't jump up to the higher rate until you hit €52,000. And in the Irish Independent this morning, suicide among priests must be urgently addressed. A senior Catholic priest has warned as he revealed that a number of clerics have died by suicide in Ireland in recent years. Father Michael Tooney, who is parish priest of the St. Carlo's Acutis pastoral area in the Diocese of Waterford and Lismore, said the tragedy of these deaths was a call to action. Speaking ahead of International Men's Mental Health Week, the priest said there was a tendency to place priests on a pedestal, expecting them to always be strong, joyful and immune to the struggles of life. But we know that that simply isn't the case. It's even though you can have some friends around you, it is a life of solitude, and yet you have often all of the other things in life to deal with: how you feel about yourself, your own mental health, you're worrying about your own health, relationships, all that kind of stuff as well. It's tough, and it's something that we're well aware of in this part of the world. And finally, to sport, Donegal, well, they have the summer off, sadly. Jim McGuinness insisted the race for Sam is wide open after watching his Donegal team crash out of the Championship. Dublin will go into this morning's All-Ireland quarter-final draw after beating Donegal 226 to 222 after extra time. It felt like maybe that wondrous kick from Murphy was a bit of luck, a rub of the green, and that things could turn around. But Donegal just didn't seemingly have it in the legs. What's your reflection on the performance? And where to now? What do you think happens next? Will Jim McGuinness be back next season? Will Michael Murphy? Are there others that maybe now they feel is the time to step away? Could we see a significant change in the setup? It's very hard after putting everything in that they did for that season, if you're right at the end of your career, or maybe mulling over your options to sort of, you know, go back to training in December and November and start the league in January, when you can maybe just have a bit of fun and take it very seriously with your club and take this pressure off you. I don't know. Is this a huge turning point for Donegal, do you think? Or will this management and group of players stick it out? What do you think? Well, Dublin can get caught. Well, I'll tell you who they got, because I have the draw here in front of me. So the quarterfinals, Tyrone have been drawn to play Kerry. Kerry are going to be incredibly hard to beat for anyone. I think Kerry, there's a level and then there's levels below it, and I think Kerry are just up there. Galway are going to play Dublin, which is a good game. It's going to be a good game. Dublin will come out on top of that, won't they? Cork will face Mayo. You can toss that coin. And Louth will face off against Monaghan. So I'd imagine we'll have an Ulster team in the semis. What do you think? So what do you think about the weekend's GEA action? Let us know. I'm joined on the programme now by Damien McCrory, who's principal of St Eunan's College in Letterkenny. And as we know, Tadhg Callaghan Carter was a student at St Eunan's College. Thank you for joining us, Damien. And I say this with my hand on my heart, I would love to be speaking to you about anything else other than the tragic loss of a wonderful student this morning.
Yeah, and I would rather be speaking about anything else at all. When we left here on Friday, little did we think that we would be back in the school very, very soon, or early yesterday morning again, dealing with this situation. But first of all, I just want to say, I know I've spoke with Demelza and the family, and I've been out with them yesterday morning, but I just want to pass on the school's sympathies, okay, on the passing of Tadhg. To Demelza and Ian, and to sisters Haley, Amy, and brother Orne. Okay, so it's just a devastating time for them, a devastating time for ourselves, and everyone is devastated. And I think that's the only way we can describe it at the moment.
Tadhg, an incredibly popular member and valued member of the school community, wasn't he? Very well known, very active within the school.
He was. Like he spent the 3 years junior house with us. He just completed his junior cycle exams there just over a week ago. And I was no doubt was looking forward to the summer. He had planned to go into fifth year, so all his choices and all of that were made. He was a young man full of energy, and he enjoyed coming to school. Well, he certainly enjoyed the social aspect of school anyway. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know, it was like every other teenager, okay, you know, about coming to school or whatever, but he definitely enjoyed the social aspect and just was a character, was involved in school extracurricular, was very much involved in the Gaelic, and was involved with soccer as well, but he was part of the 15 and a half Gaelic team as too. Just a kind and respectful young man. That would sum him up.
It's incredibly difficult, so. Primarily for family, of course, but also the school community. The way life works is ordinarily, if you're 14, 15, 16, you know, you don't really experience grief and loss, or you're not supposed to. So for many students, this will be, you know, one of their experiences of that, and the most catastrophic when it's a peer. What can the school do, or what is the school doing to try and support these young people and teachers as well, I'm sure? But I suppose at this point our focus is on the students, Damien.
Well, they're our priority. I suppose staff and students are our priority. And from this news broke on Saturday evening, Saturday night, I suppose our critical incident plan has been enacted. And as I said, we were in very early yesterday morning in the school here to get things in place and to release our statement and just to start organising. So the school is open today from 11. We have a mass that's been said in the school here at 12. You know, there's NEPS, that's the National Educational Psychological Service. They're going to be in from 10 onwards this morning as well. And the staff have been fantastic and very supportive, and they're going to be on hand today as well to help out anyone that needs that. And I suppose it's just there, you know, it's just we're creating a space where people can come to and grieve and also share their stories and their happy memories off Tadhg, and you know, we'll have some refreshments afterwards. I'm also mindful of the fact that we do have the Leaving Cert is still continuing, and we have students in doing that today and tomorrow, so we're mindful of that as well. So we're just trying. So there was a lot of organisation to do yesterday, okay, just to try to accommodate everyone, okay, and just to make sure that they're all. But our priority now is with the students, and it can be difficult because you know, a lot of the year groups, bar the Leaving Certs, you know, there's they're all finished for the summer. So, you know, this is our way now to try and link in with them. And of course, we'll be here at the the next few months, okay, may be difficult for some of them, and we need to, you know, we need to be here for them, and we will be here for them.
Okay, Damien, thank you very much indeed. It is, of course, Damien McCrory, Principal of St. Union's College Letterkenny. We're joined on the programme now by the press officer with Motorsport Ireland, Art McCarrick. Art, thanks for joining us this morning in the most, for the most tragic of circumstances, incredibly, incredibly sad events at the weekend.
Yeah, beyond tragic. And, you know, first of all, I'd just like to start by offering my condolences to Tig's family. You know, anyone that goes to a sporting event goes to enjoy it and enjoy the spectacle, and it's just extremely sad how everything turned out on Saturday evening.
From the Motor Ireland perspective, what happens next in terms of an investigation? I know a press statement was released stating that you would be one of the agencies looking into all events surrounding this tragic event.
Yeah, correct. So I suppose, you know, we do our investigation to one, obviously trying to get to the bottom of what happened, and the second one is to try and see what learnings or recommendations, if any, can be put in place, because there's, you know, numerous factors here. You know, where spectators stand, the car, the road conditions, all of those things. So there's a very large number of parameters that that would factor into it, but it's mainly from our point of view to get to the learnings of this. You know, the last spectator fatality we had at a Motorsport Ireland event was in 2012. That was in Cavan, and you know, well, since then we've run anywhere between 25 and 30 rallies a year. You know, so hundreds of rallies, thousands of stages, and yes, there has been incidences, but no spectator fatalities, unfortunately, and until Saturday evening.
Now, while it's very early in any process, and I certainly wouldn't want to try and predetermine any outcomes, but people would know there are systems in place, sweepers that would go through stages and other measures. At this point, is there any early indication of was all of that stuff carried out? What did those doing it feedback?
Certainly, I can confirm that all that did happen. Yes, the safety caravan traverses through the safety delegate and then the four 00 safety cars, and before the first competing car is let into the stage. The stage wouldn't have been allowed to start if it wasn't set up correctly in accordance with the safety plan. But, you know, situations can evolve. Whether that happened in this case or not, I don't know. But certainly when the stage started with car number two leaving the line, it would have been set up in accordance with our safety plan and deemed safe to run. Obviously, people aren't corralled into pens and may move, but like, we just don't know that at the minute. And it was the second competing car that went off the road. It all happened quite quick. So, yeah, we'll be looking to get to the bottom of that for sure.
Okay. Art McCarrick, PRO or press officer with Motorsport Ireland and Donegal Motor Club, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're joined on the programme now by Inspector Sean McDade, who's Community Engagement Inspector with responsibility for roads in Donegal. And of course, there is going to be an appeal made, Sean, but I'm sure you want to join with everyone who's been speaking about this so far in offering yours and Angada Shia Khanna's condolences to Tig's family.
Absolutely, Greg. It's an awful tragedy. And the guards would offer our condolences to Callaghan Carter family.
Now, there will be a huge appetite for answers and information, obviously in terms of an investigation, but also by those that are affected by this, and much of that responsibility falls to Angada Shia Khanna. So I presume the nature of the investigation is to gather as much information as is possible.
That's correct, Greg. And as such, the guards are appealing for any witnesses who were present at Location 15 on Special Stage 12 at Garton, particularly those with mobile phone footage in the area, to contact Letterkenny Garda Station on 07491 67100, or the Garda Confidential line on 1-800-666-111. We would also ask that and make an appeal to anybody with footage or who has forwarded footage not to share that with anyone.
I think there was a window of time whereby people didn't realise it was as serious as it was, and there was footage for sure circulating, but now we want people to desist in that because obviously it's far more sensitive. When you look for footage, Sean, it's not necessarily just of the incident itself. Presumably it's the minutes leading up to the incident as well. So what I'm trying to get at here is, you know, if anyone was videoing the first car and waiting for the second car to come through and have that footage, you know, anything at all would help. And it's, you're actually assisting, presumably, not just the investigation, but the family as well in trying to find out and ascertain precisely what happened.
That's correct, Greg. Anybody with any footage, as you say, from the first car gone past until the time of the collision, we would be grateful if you could forward that or make yourself available, and we'll call you back.
Okay. People are familiar with the numbers. Is there anything else you need to add, Sean, or are you happy to leave it at that?
I'm happy to leave it at that.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Inspector Sean McDade, and, you know, any Garda station would be perfectly fine or to make contact with in relation to that. Right, we are going to take a break. Now, a former school teacher who decently and sexually assaulted 19 victims over 25 years has been jailed for 6.5 years at Donegal Circuit Criminal Court. 83-year-old Patrick Sharkey pleaded guilty to 132 sex offences, ranging from indecent to sexual assault against 19 victims aged between 7 and 16 years. And this ran from 1970 to 1995. Sharkey was a former teacher in Coleraine, but took many of his victims on trips to Donegal and Dublin for water sports activities where he assaulted them. And Gary Duffy, solicitor of KRW Law. Gary, firstly, people might be curious, if you don't mind, addressing why, given the fact that Sharkey was based in Derry, this was tried in Donegal.
Yes, well, it was tried in Donegal because the vast majority of the offences either happened in Donegal, or a number of offences also happened in Dublin and other places like that. But the while he was based in Coleraine, he would bring his victims to remote locations in Donegal where the abuse took place.
And what do we know about his crimes and how he was able to get away with it for so long, Gary?
Well, the fact that he got away for so long is actually shocking to us and to our clients. So he was a teacher in a school, and he ran an after schools club, and at times a Duke of Ed award scheme, Duke of Edinburgh's award scheme, where, and through that, he would organise these trips away. He would take these boys who possibly didn't get many trips away, and he would bring them to Donegal under the guise of doing rowing or camping or other sort of water sports. And then when he brought them away, that's where the abuse would took place. But how he got away for so long is the really surprising point, because we're aware that in 1982, a number of parents actually approached the principal of the school and told them that their son had told them about the abuse. Seemingly, the principal of the school did speak to other parents, the boys who were there, and it was at least slightly confirmed. But nothing happened. He continued to work there until 1995.
Right, when 82 is almost smack bang in the middle of his offending period.
Yes, that's right. There was many boys who went on to be abused who wouldn't have been at the school at the time that this was brought to the attention of the school. If the school had have acted, his abusing could have ended in 82.
Yes, and you've worked obviously with those that were his victims. Like, whilst obviously he is the perpetrator and ultimately responsible, these these people who are, you know, fully grown adults now with children of their own. I know when speaking in previous cases, and I'm sure it's the same here, Gary, that the pain of a system failure is almost as bad as harmful as the acts of the perpetrator.
Absolutely. There's real anger that, so, but for the feelings of many other people, there would be a fraction of the victims we have today. They were completely really let down, not only through the fact that there was allegations brought to the school, but seemingly it was widely known in the school. There was a phrase used for some of these boys. They were called Sharky's boys, with the implication being that there was something inappropriate going on. Seemingly this was talked about widely in the school for years. It's hard to believe that teachers weren't aware of this.
Yeah, for sure. Now, he had previously been convicted for these crimes in Northern Ireland, is that correct? And then there's a bit of a crossover and some sort of fresh charges that were pursued in Donegal.
Yes, so in the north, he was convicted in relation to three victims to do with abuse that happened in the north, so it wouldn't have included anything that did happen in Donegal. And again, it was only three victims. I have 19 who were involved in the case in Donegal. So obviously you see more people have come forward than at the time. And it's one of the reasons why ourselves and a lot of our clients have been calling on the PSNI to now act urgently to engage with them, to engage with the guards who were great in Donegal and really brought this to a head, to see if there's any more further offences that have been committed in the north. And from our instructions, it clear there is.
Whilst he pleaded guilty, there didn't seem to be any remorse.
No, I was in court with my clients over the 3 days of the sentencing hearings, and that was the distinct impression that I had got. He either seemed uninterested or slightly disdainful of when accounts were being read out or the details of the impacts on victims was read out. He really didn't seem to either care or was largely dismissive of the whole process.
I think it's important too, anyway, as well, for people who may consider taking this type of action into the future too, and they might look at the sentence and just look at it in black and white and think, what? But a custodial sentence for someone at that age, and I suppose you could argue proportionate to how much life they've left, it was taken seriously, wasn't it? I mean, are you satisfied with the sentencing, and would you see it as an encouragement for others to, if they can, you know, pursue these matters, be it against Sharky or someone else for that matter?
Yes, absolutely. The fact that he got 6 years and he's already done time in the north, I think does just highlight how serious these were taken. I had a real concern that he would have got little to no custodial sentence in the end due to his age, and not just his age, he has been complaining about health problems. So the fact that the judge did actually impose quite a considerable sentence, and you are right, due to his age now, he is looking at the vast majority, if not all of his
life behind
bars. So I do think that's positive. I do think it sends a message. I also think it sends a message that he has been found guilty at all. For many, many victims of historic abuse, the perpetrator's dead already. So, and this was very well done from all involved.
You know, you'd hope, though, wouldn't you, that this would bring some comfort to his victims, and it would, and it will to some extent, but it's by no means the end of it. Not that any conviction is the end of anything, don't get me wrong, but it's the unanswered questions. It's really trying to find out exactly what went on at St. Joseph's, why his behaviour was flagged, why he was able to continue engaging with young people when there was knowledge of those concerns, right? So that needs to be looked into.
Yes, absolutely. Thursday was a very good day for the victims. They have brought that process to an end, and they've got a conclusion, which I'm sure they would have wanted more time, but they are reasonably happy with, and they understand the sentence. But yes, there's now the question left open about the wider feelings, the feelings of the school leadership, as well as part of the government who would have investigated the school or carried out checks in the school. So all that's left open, and our clients now have initiated civil proceedings against the school to have those questions answered.
Yeah. And your clients also will want to be assured that things have changed to the point where something like this cannot happen again, or at least as much as is humanly possible is done to make sure that children are protected. And presumably, unfortunately, such is the nature of these crimes and how prolific the perpetrators are, it's possible our conversation might trigger memories or emotions with people who were his victims that haven't yet come forward yet, Gary.
Absolutely. We are aware that there is people who haven't come forward. For whatever reason, it's obviously extremely difficult to do. We're also aware that a number of people have passed away before coming forward to the authorities. Actually, on Thursday, there was a number of parents of boys who we believe were abused who have sadly passed away, who were in the court to see, at least maybe not for them or for their children, but they got some measure of comfort. But yes, but we do imagine he was such a prolific abuser that it is unlikely that it was just the 19 who were in the court, that there was likely or potentially many more.
All right, Gary, listen, thanks for your time. I do appreciate
it.
All right, Gary Duffy, solicitor of KRW Law. The Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, by the way, provides services to men and women who are affected by rape, sexual assault, sexual harassment or childhood sexual abuse. Their helpline is 1-800-77-8888 if you were affected by that item. As we kind of flagged a little earlier on in the programme, Keir Starmer has resigned as UK Prime Minister, this after 2 years in position. It feels like it was much longer than that, but obviously he was under pressure to resign with Andy Burnham waiting in the wings or trampling all over the stage with him. But anyway, Keir Starmer has resigned as UK Prime Minister after just 2 years in the job. And you might remember 90 Labour MPs had put pressure on Starmer to resign. And this ultimate departure came after Andy Burnham's win in the Makerfield by-election. I'm not sure if he's set out a pathway. I haven't seen the breaking news yet. I'm not sure if he's set out a pathway to go or if he's just going straight off. If it were me, I would pack my stuff and get out of there ASAP. Now, just a little bit of a heads up for you, something that's taking place this evening. The organisers of the Clonmany Festival are hosting a volunteer information evening tonight in St Mary's Hall, Clonmany. It starts at 7:30 p.m. and you'll be out of there by 9. So whether you're volunteered before or are considering getting involved for the very first time, the organisers would love to see you there, and this is the time to register your interest and find out how you can help make this year's festival a continued success. So organisers will be on hand throughout the evening to take your details, answer any questions you might have, and to discuss different ways that you can get involved. And they say that volunteers are at the heart of Clonmany Festival, and every contribution, big or small, is greatly appreciated. So if you're interested in helping out in any way, shape or form, feel free to get along for an hour and a half this evening at St Mary's Hall, Clonmany, 7:30 to 9 p.m. Heads up on a scam from the weekend. A caller says, I got a call on Saturday to say that Three were offering me discounts on my Three phone bill. I'm on prepay, so I don't have a bill. She insisted that she'd send me a discount code and I'd get 40% discount. She claimed it was getting it. I was getting it because I paid my bill on time. I knew it was a scam because I was prepaid, but just to warn people in case they'd fall for it. That's just absolute confirmation that those scams are going around, because the Gardaí flagged it there for us on Tuesday. Now, Christy Murray, the Donegal Piper, is with me on the programme now. Christy, thanks for joining me.
No bother. Okay.
Right, disappointment, because, you know, you are obviously part of the furniture when it comes to inter-county football involving Donegal, but not on Sunday. You weren't allowed to play?
No, I wasn't allowed to play. This was going on a number of years. Like 25 years I've been playing in and out of Croke Park whenever we were there. 20 of those years, absolutely no bother at all. In the last few years, there's been kind of standoffs. The league final, I was escorted to get a hold for the pipes with two guards. And I didn't feel good. You know, I have a health issue, and I thought I better go to the car before something happens. But I wrote a letter to the board then, and they sent it on to Croke Park. So I was trying to do things kind of quietly, not go to papers or anything, because I thought let's get this sorted out. And I just walked into a trap yesterday. They were ready for me.
And what exactly happened yesterday then? I know you've sort of outlined it, but talk me through it. How did your day unfold yesterday in terms of from when you arrived at Croke Park?
So what I normally do is I pipe around Jones Road, having my usual fun photographs. In fact, there were a couple of promos done by committee members, Donegal. One for a draw for 250,000. Another one was just a promo for the day that's in it. And I actually asked one of the members, did you sort out the stewards? And they just kind of laughed and walked away. Not in a bad way, just, you know. But I thought, no, I don't have a bad feeling here. Mm. So I played away and then decided to go in early enough in case there was an issue. And the first thing I was shown to the bag search earlier, which was new. Mm. And your boy says, you're not playing them in there today. I said, what's the issue today? And he says, no, there's no movement on this year. I said, well, can I get your boss then? And he says, oh, he's off the same line. Then he pointed to any items weren't allowed into the grounds. And I knew this. You see this on the program.
Yeah.
And they added bagpipes on it.
Wow. So you were specifically targeted here, right?
I was targeted. That's what I meant. There was a trap. Mm. I took that really bad. I just, that galled me. And I said, that's harassment. I said, that's just picking on me. And I said, what's the next step here? And he says, guards. And I said, well, get the guards. Like I said, when you sort this one way or another, I'm walking away or sorted. So we got the guards. Not much the guard could do. He wasn't too bad. He just talked. We were going around in circles. And somebody rang. There was another manager there. She was quite quiet, but she was making sure I wasn't going in with the pipes. And then Mary Coughlin came on the scene then, and she knew about the letter, and she also knows about my situation too. Mm. And it went around in circles for a good 10-15 minutes, and there was no movement. And I said, right, I've made my decision, and I asked my two friends to go into Croke Park. I didn't want any hassles. The funny thing was, people were still coming for photos in the midst of the whole mayhem, and that was quite funny, actually.
Yeah, they're oblivious to what was going on. They probably wouldn't believe that was going on.
Oblivious to what was happening. Yeah.
So what next Christy? Because this is the only ground in the country that you're forbidden to enter.
Yeah, well, I look back and what am I doing wrong? And they did, back 5 years ago, they did mention noise pollution, more or less. as, you know, they brought that in. And I said at the time, well, I didn't turn my pipes up over the 20 years. I said, there's not any louder. And they said, well, I don't want you piping out where the people are seated. And I said, well, there isn't much point because the PA system's so good, you can't hear the pipes.
Yeah.
So I always played in the concourse. I didn't break any rules. I stayed civil yesterday and tried to do it that way. I was disappointed in the way it was left hanging from, I don't know, from the board and from Croke Park. I thought somebody could have empathy and try to have a softer landing for me.
Well, you see, also, I know what you're saying, but also, right, people might argue setting precedent, what happens next if you come in with drums or whatever it might be. But the bottom line is this is something that's been going on for ages, and you could implement something else, but also give exceptions as well. There could have been a solution to this. Christy, listen, we'll chase up with you to see what the story is. We'll put a note into Croke Park to try and find out specifically what they say about this, and we'll touch base. Thanks very much for joining us.
They'll go ahead. They'll just mention hold to you.
Of course.
They'll just mention the hold to you. They keep saying, you're not... Yeah, okay.
I know what you're saying. It's frustrated. Yeah, I know what you're saying. But listen, once you get something on the record, though, you can work with that. I'm always a big fan of that, Christy, because if you get something in black and white, you can work from there. So we'll see. Thanks very much for joining us. Brendan Devaney has made his way back from Dublin after yesterday's game. Donegal v Dublin. Dublin are through. What's your views on what happened yesterday?
There's a good summing up there myself. Brendan Gilcoyne and Park Overy had a had a chat after the game. Yeah, listen, it's been a very strange championship, to say the least. So just digesting it all. I think obviously Greg, we overcooked the league. We hit the ground running very hard. I think probably on the back of maybe what happened in the All-Ireland final. And, you know, we won the McKenna Cup and we won the National League. And then you can see, obviously, that the energy wasn't there, you know.
But you, when we've had this same complaint in the past, we've been forced to play a game straight after the league and then multiple games in a row and this, that and that. And there was every excuse in the book. Is there? Can we really point to the fact that, you know, there was nothing left in the legs after a busy league and championship?
See, Greg, this is hard to get your head around because we played far less games. So people say, well, sure, how could we be lacking in energy? But the reality is now, we obviously put so much effort into the league. And you can't keep going back to the well. This has happened many, many times.
Oh, there's certainly then not a problem that we're overtraining between games then. Well, because when you've got top-tier players cramping and they haven't played a competitive inter-county match for 3 or 4 weeks... And people are asking to be subbed off for, you know what I mean? Like, is that the training too intensive?
It's not the heavy training people think about the pre-season training. That's obviously not happening. But even at training every night, you need to hit a certain level of intensity. Either that's happening a bit too often where, you know, you're playing in-house games and they're hyped up a lot. And then when you come into the match, you can't kind of get up there again. I mean, going back away as far as 2007, this happened to us. I remember taking the door off the hinges nearly at a game in the end of January in Healy Park. And at the end of that summer, we ended up back there in our last game of championship. And there was hardly a noise coming out because we had overextended ourselves in the league. Mm. Now, we didn't think with this Donegal team and, you know, the management and the preparation there that would happen, because everybody's thinking about it's a short, close season. You know, you taper everything to suit. But certainly the only thing you can point to is because, you know, Greg, we were flat against Cork, you know, first half against Kerry, very good. Flat against Down, flat against second half, certainly against Cork. And then yesterday, it was do or die game. It was a bit better from us. First half wasn't too bad. There was moments in there. But when the game's in the melting pot, as in the second half, now obviously Ryan McEwen and Oisin Gillam were kept back. So I think the management were trying to deal with what happened the week before. But the reality was, and I was saying yesterday, I think, you know, into that added time, there was a stage where...
So really what you're saying is that we didn't field our best team to try and hold Dublin so that when we need to switch it up a little bit, we bring some of our best players on. That, to me, tactically seems a little bit desperate.
Well, it's more just playing the hand that you have. Okay. You know, if Ryan McHugh has to come off, as he often does at a certain period in the game, and if Oisin Gillam is a cramping problem, then in the Donegal management head, it's better having them on to finish the game when the game needs to be won. Now, I was saying to you, it was funny, Oisin Gillam was involved in a moment there in the added time where four Dublin players surrounded him out in the midfield, and then when Dublin got inside our defence, you know, they skipped in and it was a simple shot, came off the post. And our intensity had gone completely at that stage. And really, Dublin should have beat us in normal time. Like, so, you know, for a team that was lining up for another All-Ireland, I mean, you look at it right, in the Armagh games the last couple of years, we were down and out a few times, but we had come back. We would find the energy, we would somebody would come up with a bit of brilliance. You know, when you think about Monaghan last year in the quarter-final, first half we were poor, but then we came at them second half. Me threw the kitchen sink at us first half. Then we came at them and destroyed them. So there was always Donegal were coming after you at some stage, or there would be levels. But whereas this team now, the energy just seemed to completely go.
Well, that's
the
lack of energy. And we've seen it before, and you perhaps even could go back to the All-Ireland final last year, you know, where it seems like there was nothing left in the legs or whatever it might be. I know Jim McGuinness talks of the aggression of Kerry. So what next? It's very, very early doors, okay, but there are players that sort of came out of retirement. There are players that sort of perhaps said, right, I'll give it another year. You know, Jim McGuinness normally is building, isn't that right? You know how you would see. Is this his third year?
Third year
distance. So what is next?
The fourth year was, I think, up to him. That was to be spoke about between him and the county board. I think when he was ratified, it was a 3-year with a possible 4. So I suppose that's up to them to decide now where they want to.
But he'll want to sort of get counsel too from some of the major players that arguably are coming to the end of their career. Do they want to go again? Do they want to start training in the dark nights of December and January to play inter-county?
Yeah, that's it. Listen, I suppose you're looking, way, you're looking at Michael Murphy. I mean, what Michael's done coming out of retirement to play the last couple of years has been absolutely phenomenal. Like, can that continue? I mean, no, I wouldn't put anything past Michael, but, you know, that took some effort for him to do that there. Obviously, Paddy Birdie stepped down, Niall O'Donnell went away. And initially in the league, we didn't notice them things, Greg, but when it came to the championship, again, you need players like that around. I know Patrick retired or whatever, but even the likes of Niall not being in there was a loss for us. But if you look at teams, like look at Kerry, for example, right? Really poor in the league, didn't seem to care, wanted to stay in the division, that was it. Ended up in the league final, they didn't want to be there. And now they are coming good guns.
Well, they're
the
unbeatable, aren't
you
they?
You look at Tyrone as well, Greg. Tyrone have had a terrible league, you know, really.
Yes, but is Tyrone not going to find out, like Armagh did, how good Kerry is?
Yeah, but they're in the All-Ireland quarter-final. I'm just saying that when it was needed for them late on in games against Roscommon and Mayo, they still won the match. Whereas we can't put ourselves in the position to do that because you can see that Donegal are out on their feet. You know, particularly in that first period out of time, Dublin completely destroyed us. And we couldn't even get a kick out of the way. It was funny, the couple of short kicks that Ryan McHugh went back, used his bit of intelligence and picked up the ball. How we couldn't work a short kick in that first period of extra time just to get us the ball, to get us up the pitch. So, yeah, listen, it's something like Donegal were being touted as All-Ireland contenders. And if you're going to do that, everything has to be primed for the championship. And we obviously weren't ready for that.
No, we weren't ready for Louth.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, Louth are in there now. If you look at Louth, they had their bad game in Leinster when Dublin hammered them. Yeah. But they've come back now, but everybody's priming for the championship.
Yeah, but that is in and of itself, though, something that we need to look at as to, you know, like, I remember having bats and forwards of whether we'd go for the league and everything. Yeah, we're going to go for the league. But then, you know, look, arguably we put so much into that. Look where we're at now. Anyway, all of this is going to be teased out in its entirety and reflections on all other things GEA on the DL debate. Kevin Cassidy's in. Does he pull his punches?
My man.
Does he pull
his punches? Hang about.
No, he does not. Cunningham?
Yeah, Kieran Cunningham. Listen, Kieran's a brilliant guy for summing things up. And we're waiting on one ex-county player, Greg, that had played in both Jim's tenures. I'd like to get a bit of context into all this. You know, listen, we had a brilliant couple of years leading up to this season, and from the National League, we're going back to Croke Park for the big All-Ireland quarters and semis. So, listen, left a lot of heads
scratching. Brilliant stuff. Thanks so much for squeezing us in, Bren. And the DL debate tonight from 7 o'clock. But you can listen to it whenever you like as a podcast shortly thereafter. McCullough says, on the issue of GEA, no energy. Kerry played more games than us. No energy, such rubbish, says that listener. Another, they hardly won the ball yesterday, too busy running back towards their own goal too often, and they simply then, the listener concludes, ran out of steam. On the issue of free legal aid, which came up quite a bit yesterday, on Friday, a caller says, I'm a single mother, 4 young children. I had to attend court to get maintenance for my children, which my ex would withhold and set days for him to have access, even though he was completely unreliable and inconsistent. I was denied legal aid as my income was over €18,000 a year. They would not take into account my expenses at all. If I was a drug dealer, thief, child abuser, etc., I'd get legal aid straight away. That's all you see in the Donegal newspapers. Judge grants legal aid. The judicial system is a joke. Yes, sometimes you do see legal aid being awarded and you wonder, really? But I suppose you have to consider that maybe we don't know all the circumstances, but that caller certainly did in her case. A few people were making the connection between Muslims and Christie and his pipes, interestingly. Quite a number of people saying exactly the same thing. Christie can't get in, but Muslims can, which is kind of, I don't know, not in the spirit of the GEA and everything it all stands for, is it? But anyway, there you go. That's what people are feeling. Let me see, there's more in relation to that. There's a few on the rally, by the way, and I fully understand. I fully understand why people are saying what they are saying, but some of them would be deemed, you know, kind of insensitive in their timing. But they are all read and all noted. I'm not criticising anyone. These comments are coming from a nice place, a place of care and what have you. But at the same time, we do have to be conscious not to upset people. In relation to that, some people saying it's time that rallying per se was finished as a whole, but instances, though this is no comfort whatsoever, instances whereby people are injured or seriously injured or killed are incredibly rare. But as I say, that is cold comfort this morning. Hi, Greg. First, I'd like to offer my condolences to the family of the young man who tragically lost his life on Saturday. May he rest in peace. But my point in texting is that yesterday, while I was out working, I had the misfortune to go over Nocola Road, over Nocola about 4 p.m. And what I seen was unbelievable. Firstly, for all these people, number one, to show total disregard for the passing of a young man as if it was nothing. And number two, for the Gardaí to allow mob rule to actually block a main road and do nothing about it is actually quite shocking. And believe me, they weren't there. I seen plenty of guards standing in groups all weekend doing little, but that's what they're doing, they're present, right? But when they should have been on duty as well, they weren't there to be seen. What would have happened yesterday if an ambulance had to get through? I'm not sure what this is referencing. I don't have the context, but presumably there was a gathering of people, and this caller believes it was insensitive or inappropriate. Okay. Now, last week saw a remarkable homecoming in St. Johnstone, where a little boy's journey through serious illness has been carried every step of the way by family, neighbours and entire community. At the heart of it all is a song, My Donegal, sung in hospital rooms through the hardest days, even while he was sedated, and again in celebration as he finally returned home. In a package, we hear how a Berlin heart expert, months of treatment and life explant, I beg your pardon, months of treatment and life-threatening illness became a story not just of survival, but of connection, hope and place. From handmade posters and a village marquee to a Garda and rally car escort, the welcome home was an emotional one, as it was unforgettable. I'm talking about the return home of Davin Corran. The family of the two-year-old told our Donna Marie Doherty about the toddler's journey home.
This was the sound the people of St. Johnstone have been waiting months to hear. The sound of Davin Corran finally coming home. The two-year-old became unwell in January with parvovirus infection, which quickly began to attack his heart. His aunt Lisa Crawford told me that despite his long journey ahead, today was a day to be celebrated.
But today is all about coming home to Donegal, to St. Johnstone, because he hasn't been here in 6 months, and it's a big thing. It's a big thing for the whole family. None of them have been here, and for Megan and Barry too. It's a cloud lifted, a dark cloud has been lifted, you know, so it's great to be here today to celebrate that. And
it may have felt like times that this day was never going to come, so it'll be such a relief to see the corridor open and to see him.
Yeah, do you know what? It's been 6 months, and it's a low... It has flew, but I'm sure it has dragged for Megan and Barry also, do you know? So, but we did think this day was never going to come, but I can't even believe it's here at the same time.
His parents, Barry and Megan, detailed what the last half year looked like for their family. Davin is the second youngest of four children, and in the past 5 months, he suffered a cardiac arrest, a stroke, and was heavily sedated.
Davin took parvovirus, myocarditis, so it's basically slap cheek, but it basically attacked his heart and put him into severe heart failure. So he was taken to Dublin, to Crumlin Hospital, and whenever he got to Crumlin, they put him on the ventilator, and obviously he deteriorated again, so they put him on ECMO, life support. And he was stayed on that for around 2 weeks. He wasn't making any progress. Sorry, before that, he actually took a cardiac arrest. That's why they put him on ECMO. So they weren't seeing any progress. So it was a case of, right, well, what's the next step? So that's where the Berlin Heart comes in. So he was transferred from Crumlin to the Freeman Hospital in Newcastle, which where offers that it's the transplant program the Berlin Heart falls under. So you have to be eligible for a heart transplant to get the Berlin Heart. So that was okay. Davin was transferred with the intention of getting the Berlin Heart. But whilst a few days into our stay in the Freeman, Davin took a stroke. Which then it was a case of they didn't know what his quality of life was going to be, so they didn't know if they were going to give it to him or not.
So basically, he was no longer a candidate for the Berlin Heart because of the stroke, so they felt that he may not have the quality of life for basically to give him that opportunity. So they wanted to wait for about 6 weeks to do an MRI to see if he was eligible again. So during that time, Davin was taken off the transplant list.
Yeah.
And he was taken off the transfer to get the Berlin Heart. And we were basically told to prepare for the worst and that to gather all family over because we'll need the support because the next few days was crucial and they didn't expect him to survive. So his mum was a great advocate for him and a great fight, and she, no matter what the facts were about Davin and his survival rate and his quality of life, his mother always fought for him. And she always said that she would never give up until he told her that he was finished trying. And then after 2 weeks of fighting, we got the MRI and Davin was eligible again for the Berlin Heart, which we were going for.
We both fought.
Yeah.
We both did. And I'm glad we did.
Yeah. So when he got his Berlin Heart, once he got the Berlin Heart, that was the start of his recovery journey. So it was sedated for probably the best part of 10 weeks.
Yeah.
So we didn't really see him much. We were just watching him on a bed just as they worked with him. And then around the end of March, then we started to see some sort of recovery. Davin's heart was starting to shrink again with the Berlin Heart, which was amazing.
It was on the Berlin Heart 77 days altogether. But they had told us kind of about 3 weeks before that they had done the stress test. So it's a series of stress tests over the course of 3 days. And he passed and the three stress tests. And it's funny because they had told us most kids don't actually pass. It's a case of, we'll try again in another few weeks. But Davin surprised everybody again and passed the three stress tests. And they said that he was eligible for explant. So, obviously, we were delighted over the moon.
The toddler was the seventh person to be explanted from a Berlin Heart. He came home to a huge welcome from family, friends and neighbours, with handmade posters, a marquee, a face painting and even an ice cream van. A Garda and Rally Corps escort brought him home to Ard Bathin as the crowd sang My Donegal, a song his mother and nurses had sung to him even while he was sedated. His uncle, Eamon Peoples, said the strength of the community can't be underestimated.
We're very, very overwhelmed and proud, I suppose, by the community, the way they come together today for Davin's homecoming. And to be honest, it brought a tear to my eye now. And I was kind of lost for words here. But no, it's Tom's rendition of Home to Donegal and just really set us off, you know. It was absolutely magnificent. It's just a magnificent day. Mickey P leading the line up and the Garda escort, the whole works, and seeing Davin. I haven't seen Davin since the 7th of February, and the last day that I seen Davin, I thought it was going to be my last day seeing Davin. And I just to see him today, when he came up, my heart just broke, to be honest. It was very, 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 very overwhelming for me. And I think it was for most of the family and even most of the people that doesn't know Davin, that has got to know him only through the journey. And it's just great to see everybody and such a strong community just pull together and support. And I mean, even the day and setting up everything, food and what a day, you know, and what an evening new we'll have in store celebration. I can't thank everyone enough, and I can't thank Chris McNulty and William Coyle and obviously Highland Radio, you know, so much for their help along the way and support, you know, and getting the message out there that everybody's here tonight, you know. I owe you all a massive thanks as well, as do all the family, you know, and we all appreciate everything you've done for us. And the community, we thank the community so much, and the wider community again, for their support today and throughout Davin's journey, because that was one hell of a journey. We didn't know where we were coming or going, and as I say, there's not one of us thought for a second we would ever see him again. I would just like to thank everyone, and I hope everyone has a great evening. And again, I would just like to say Tom's rendition of Home to Donegal, it has to be number one next week, and I would I would like to hear him on the radio soon. Thanks very much, folks.
This is my homeland, the place I was born in. No matter where I go, it's in my soul. My feet may wander a thousand places, but my heart will lead me back home to my Donegal.
There you have it. It made the radio, didn't it? And a wonderful rendition and a wonderful package from Donna Marie. Doherty there. That's two bangers in 2 days now from Donna Marie. Check out our socials if you missed any of that. And it's just wonderful. Life is really, really tough, and life has been really tough for the Curran family. But then when you hear those words, and those of you watching were able to see the images of that little fighter who never gave up, did he? And he's at home, and there's a lovely, I wonder if his brother is sitting in the car with, and there's just another young lad sitting behind him, and it's just a little bit of complete and natural affection there, and that really actually struck a chord with me. But anyway, listen, fantastic package. If you missed any of that, you can listen to it back in the podcast. But of course, Donna Marie will make it available for you to listen at your leisure on our social media. Plenty of you commenting on the football. I picked up in what Jim McGuinness said yesterday that there was no training. Wonder what he meant by it. I'm not quite sure. I didn't hear the comments directly. The Sam Maguire Cup is for the Sunshine Boys. Another, I think, if Jim goes, that Michael could be manager. Would he want something like that? I mean, it's completely up to Jim McGuinness. There's no calls or there's no mood or attitude for Jim McGuinness to go anywhere. What Jim McGuinness has done for this county is astonishing. I mean, you know, we've won the league this year. You know, we lost out to the mighty Dublin in Croke Park, one game away from the quarters. You know, let's not lose the run of ourselves. I mean, that would a remarkable season if we were to go back 2, 3, 4 years. You know what I mean? You know, it's like everything, I suppose. You can't run away with the positives, and you certainly shouldn't run away with the disappointing season. There's 32 counties, 34 actually, I suppose, if you chuck in others. Not that all compete in the championship, but don't get me wrong. You know, and we're there or thereabouts. We're top eight or on the cusp, you know, so. Christie's Pipes here. No way to treat Christie. He brings great atmosphere to the game. Last Saturday I was in Ballybuffet. He got the fans in a good mood before the game and half time. Shame on the GEA time it was challenged. And indeed, I believe there was a challenge to it. And of course, Christie and his family going through a very difficult time at the moment with his nephew still missing, of course. Another says the GEA banned Christie because they could not make any money out of him. The Grab All Association, believes the listener. Another, the reality on GEA, the reality is first of all, Michael Murphy has had his time, now walk away. Jim needs to change the tactics. New blood needs to be introduced into this Donegal team. There are plenty of excellent players that never get a chance. Donegal need a brand new approach altogether, full stop. Listen, we've seen this actually with the ladies GEA team, if you don't mind me saying, and I'm not a sports person, but I watch on. Like, when you've got stalwarts that are there, I would not like to be the manager, and this is a skill test whereby you look at McHugh, you look at Murphy and others, right, who arguably are towards the end of the career. In fact, Murphy's was, and then he came back. And then you say, right, well, at what stage do you balance youth and players that haven't necessarily got big time? Like, for instance, would a debutante have been able to settle themselves and kick that two-pointer that gave us extra time yesterday? Or was Michael Murphy really one of only a few people that actually, A, would step up and take that kick, or B, you know, not to actually put it over, right? So there's always a balancing act between experience and new players. And there's no doubt we're on a journey. But what was I going to say about the ladies? Yeah, they had a bumpy transition from a very successful team, a lot of them stepping away at the same time, and then have to have patience as a new crop of young players are being built. The men, there is a crossover there. Do you know what I mean? There's a transitional period that I presume we're going to sort of enter into if we haven't already entered. So the future is very bright. And as I say, you know, we're there, thereabouts, top eight. and we were, you know, a couple of minutes away, arguably, from a quarterfinal, and the mood would be very different then. All right, most of us love the water living in this part of the world. Why wouldn't you? And now we're seeing that weather where people are back out on it again. Some people are out all year round, but don't get me wrong. In fact, we were out fishing ourselves yesterday, and glad to report I've done very little to damage fish stocks off the Irish coast, it has to be said. But anyway, Hans has a different story of the sea, of the water. Good morning to you, Hans. Thanks for your time.
Good morning to you, Greg, and the team and the whole community. I hope that everyone's doing well, whereby I've heard about the tragic death of young Tyke only this morning. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for having me here on your show today. I have to apologize to all for my English being far from fluent, which might be annoying or constitute the risk of misunderstandings when possibly the much debated subject of veganism will be brought up later on. I don't know. I'm just saying because I don't want to upset or even irritate anyone, and there's no reason to become so, I'm sure.
It's okay. You don't need to pussyfoot around it. Just tell us the story. We can take it, Hans. So you were out and about on Friday. What did you come across?
You never know. I've contacted Highland Radio to tell an incident that happened last Friday afternoon between 4:15 and 4:45 on a stretch of the Donegal shores, which I don't want to locate more specifically for the sake and protection of the animals involved. Mm. At the time when walking down the beach line, it happened that four kayakers caught up with me. They were three men and a woman in a double. Their boats all blue and apparently borrowed, I'd say. I engaged in a conversation with one of them, from which I learned that this party came from Letterkenny, hoping to see seals. I said that they would very likely see some, as in fact we had already reached the seals at the time, and I jokingly added that they should be careful not to bump into one. However, I also seriously added to be cautious because the seals have their young now at this time of the year, you know. However, the thing is, only a couple of minutes later, I really could hardly believe my eyes when I saw those kayakers downright landing on two or three of those rocky sandbanks, which are only typical for Donegal or the western coastline, but that in this case really represent the core habitat of the seals. Unsurprisingly, all the seals moved into the water. But to be clear, they would have done so anyway when a boat would come anywhere near to them. I really struggled with me for a while whether to act and to shout out or not. Actually, the situation made me speechless.
Yeah.
Well, let me remark this. With an email, I provided Highland Radio with some photographs of the incident, among other things, showing a few meters of seal tracks in the sand on my side of the beach, that is opposite the seal sandbanks where the kayakers were right at that time, along with spots of red, which I take to be blood. As can be seen from the pictures, the tracks are clearly absolutely fresh and must have formed around the time the kayakers reached the area where the seals were present.
Yes.
I understand it is possible that... Yes. Okay.
No, I was just. I understand where you're coming from, Hans. But what do you believe happened? Do you believe that the kayakers, through ignorance or otherwise, that they just went on to sort of have a close-up look, not realizing that this would cause great distress to the seals and their young? Do you believe that they did something that caused, you know, physically that caused them to bleed? What do you believe happened, or maybe you actually witnessed what happened?
Well, I believe, I interpret those traces, for example, just for an example, I can't help it, I interpret this trace I've just spoken of as from a seal that had to rush over rocks.
Understood.
And
fence. Yeah. So in a panic, they might have damaged themselves. Now, when you've seen this, did you have a chance to speak to these kayakers again? And if so, what was the conversation?
Yeah, so, okay, finally it burst out of me and I shouted to the group and gestured them to get off the banks and leave the place. Reluctantly or not, in any case, the kayakers finally slowly turned and made their way back, whereby the kayakers hadn't been very quick on their way, so I could catch up with them once more indeed. And admittedly, though I called their names and I was agitated, the man I'd spoken to already earlier, a man in his 30s, I reckon, obviously was willing to engage in a discussion with me. He argued that, to his mind, the seals hadn't been distressed at all, but rather curious and playful. He said that the seals had even approached him in his boat, but that there hadn't been any pops.
So really,
I replied, it was absurd.
I understand, but their contention was is that they did not believe that what they had done was wrong. So, you know, if we're going to be perhaps, you know, given the benefit of the doubt, they thought really they were just like David Attenborough on steroids. They thought they were going to engage with the wildlife and they didn't do anything wrong. But do you doubt that? Or, I mean, you don't think they went onto that island with any wish to harm these seals. It was more just they didn't understand, no?
No. I admit they wouldn't. That wasn't the intention at all. Yes, to disturb, to distress the animals. However, absolutely, they did so from my point of view.
Okay.
It was a core habitat, and I tried to explain that to them. However, well, I'm. One point is that in my former country, the mentioned seals habitat would certainly be a meticulously guarded nature or wildlife reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And highly likely those kayakers would have been arrested by rangers for trespassing and severely fined, I'm convinced.
Yeah.
Naturally.
You would know that hands, I suppose, because of, and I'm sorry to cut across, it's just time, I have a lot to fit in before 11, but yours is such an important issue as well. In this, like, I mean, we would not necessarily, seals can be seen as a little bit in a fishing area, can be seen as a little bit of pain in the backside, if the truth be told. Now, that doesn't mean we should do any harm for them, but I don't think they're held in the esteem that perhaps maybe in your former country they are. You mentioned veganism. You're a vegan now for... You are a vegan. Does this, do you think, irk particularly because of that, or is that just coincidence?
Well... veganism, you are vegan because of the animals, of course, and I can't deny that I'm particularly sensitive as to the well-being of animals. However, yes, what you refer to is what you indicate is a conflict between humans or fishing industry and seals. Okay, it's a natural, I'd say, a natural conflict. But I'm as a vegan, obviously. Well, this is I don't want to upset anyone, as I said introductorily, and so I don't want any fishermen or what. However, I don't consume fish. And
the one thing I would say, Hans, and I admire anyone who lives the life you live, because I couldn't. But I think really the best approach here is that. You know, to err is to be human, and that maybe this is an opportunity through your experience to just advise people as they get out into the water and enjoy our natural amenities that these are, you know, these are creatures, this is wildlife, and just to be respectful of them and their habitat, and also to look after yourselves and to be safe. Hans, thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate your time. If you have anything to say in relation to that, 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. Those are our contact details. Now, I want to go straight to Ian Harkin, who is a chairperson of Finn Harps. And it's been a challenging season. And when it's a challenging season, I suppose, on the pitch, it exacerbates the challenges off the pitch. I can only imagine, Ian.
Yeah, it's extremely difficult, to be quite honest. You know, we're all volunteers at the club. Some of us are putting in huge hours at the minute, but it's tough at the minute. There's no denying that. But there's brighter things ahead. So hopefully.
Yes. Now, apparently, and you're going to confirm this, there has been an expression of interest from a prospective investor. This is obviously a solid proposal that is going to be brought to shareholders in the near future.
Yeah. So last October, we reached out to a guy called Tom Markham. Tom's probably one of the leading people in the world, really, looking at mergers and acquisitions within the football space. So we were highly recommended. Tom came highly recommended from some of the transactions that he did in the past. The most recent one probably in Ireland was the Larne one, where he helped bring in new investment there. So yeah, we did our due diligence on Tom and reached out to him, and we gave him a very specific sort of criteria of what we wanted. Initially, Tom gave us a list of people that, you know, of contacts that he had, and we looked into their backgrounds, and I'd say about 80% of them would have been multi-club models. And we said that that wasn't something that we really were interested in. So we were very specific about what we wanted. We'd spent the last number of years as well building up our own strategic plan about how we want the club to run. And sustainability was extremely important. So yes, bringing in money is important, but we want the club to be sustainable long term. So we put a huge focus over the last number of years on our academy development, and that, you know, is bearing fruit. So in the last year, we had 13 different people from our club represent the country.
I get you, but have you also not spent a lot of time, Ian, sort of trying to increase the sense of ownership, both literally and financially, yeah, amongst the Donegal public? And does this not in some way fly in the face of all of that, that really to sell the club out to someone, maybe you can give us information, are they even football people?
Yeah, they are football people, yeah. And the person in particular, of all of the people that we looked at, they have a bigger football background than anybody else.
Yeah, but why are they investing in Finn Harms? I mean, there has to be some love of work. I mean, if they don't understand Donegal, if they don't understand the club, if they don't buy into the vision, well, then really it's just moving money through the club. Not that sounds like I'm saying something. It's not right. Don't get me wrong, but you know, like, is that not the heart and soul of what Harps is at, or are we at the point whereby it's either something like this or nothing?
No. I think there's a very, very deliberate reason why the person did it. He did start initially his look into the UK market. So he went to extreme lengths at looking at clubs in the UK. And Tom, who is, you know, he looks at both sides of it. So he looks at both the buyer and the seller. So he said, look, I have a club that matches exactly what your values are. So his values were in academy development, sustainability, community involvement, and he's extremely ambitious, right? So if you look at the UK market, and he was looking at League One at this stage, so you're looking at the UK market and the challenges of getting through League One into, you know, right up into the Premiership and into Europe, which is where his ambitions are. The challenges are huge. You know, your percentage chances of success are very, very small. Whereas you compare that to Ireland, we have two leagues, 20 teams, and four of those get into Europe each year.
So if you want the glory days of Europe, the pathway, and we've seen even with like the likes of Wrexham, when you've got massive amounts of money and they've achieved something that's completely remarkable, but if your ultimate goal was to get to the Premiership, well, then even then, they haven't managed to achieve that. And, you know, you invest big in a club, and the idea presumably is that you loan heavy to begin with, but that asset becomes so valuable that you actually start making money off it. That's really basically the business model that you see elsewhere. I presume it's here. It's not Snoop Dogg, is it? I know he's got Swansea. He's not going to be walking around smoking a blunt outside Finn Park. No, it's not him.
No. This guy, he came and visited the club. So he spent 10 days looking around the community, took him to all of the facilities that we have. We visited a number of other clubs right around the country as well, looked at what, you know, best in class is at the moment. So Ireland is actually...
So when will we know who this person is? Because I presume if you're going to go to the shareholder... This name's going to be leaked anyway, right? Because it's going to be leaked ahead of this meeting. So who is it?
No, I can't say at the moment because there's still some legal processes that have to go through.
And just in relation to that, okay, like, if I were, there's an awful lot of public money going into this club by way of development, right? Yeah. So I don't know if the cost is as things are now, or if the cost, if it's being valued post stadium completion. But we really need to be careful that there is not an abuse of public funds here. And I don't mean an abuse and a misappropriation. I'm on about effectively that there could be a little bit of, you know, column moving. And I would be uncomfortable with that. I don't know about you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but I suppose the whole point, like, this is government funding. And the government specifically, to give them credit, when they provide you with funding, they put a charge over the asset for the 25 years for LSSIF funding.
For clawback, recouping, et cetera.
Yeah, in credit to the government, they have that in place. And the investor as well is, he's willing to put in up to all of our funding for our commitment to that. So that's 1.6 million alone just on the stadium. So it's a significant investment. Just on the stadium alone. The investment then will be into the operational running of the club on a multi-year basis as well. So we'll be able to professionalise the club on and off the pitch.
How much influence might they have on who is the manager, who is signed, etc.? Is this, are we going to see a situation whereby they're prepared to take a step back, or is it going to be like Turkey a la Sheikh?
So the investor will have significant, if not full, control of the club. Yeah,
but in terms of teams, in terms of who signs for the club, etc., is what I'm saying.
They will have. Yeah, so what they'll be making key appointments themselves in terms of football people. They'll have a sporting director.
Kevin McHugh, say he was still the manager, he says, I want to sign this number 8. Ultimately, it comes down to them. They decide whether or not.
Yeah, well, even Kevin does that right now. There's a process involved. So Kevin does trials. Like he'll look at videos first of all.
Ultimately, there's a board approval or
yeah,
whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, no,
right.
No, there is,
so
yeah.
you're going to be going to this meeting, are you, Ian? Saying, look, at we've done our due diligence. I've spoken to this person. We think this is where the future of the club is. That could return the glory days. We're recommending to shareholders that you approve this investment takeover. I don't know how it's phrased. Would that be the position that the board would recommend and are recommending that this the shareholders back this?
Absolutely, yeah. No, the board is 100% behind the investment at the moment, yeah. Okay. Like, we've done our due diligence on it. We've spoken with the person. He's come and he's visited. It will probably exceed any investment that has ever come into any club in either the Republic of Ireland or Northern Ireland. So it's significant. It's not something, we've taken our time to do this, and it will be on a staged basis. So it will be linked to developments with the stadium.
Are you part of the deal, Ian?
No, I'm not.
I don't mean that you could be bought, but I'm on about just your passion and knowledge being retained, if you know what I'm saying, is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
I know you're an incredibly successful and busy person in your own right, as well as what you're doing with Finn Harps. Okay, right. So, I mean, you're saying this seems to be the best deal, that the board are saying it. Interesting. Thanks, Ian. We'll watch on.
Thank you, Greg.
Okay, look after yourself. Thank you very much indeed. Former Labour Party member Richard Logue joins me now. Are you a former member, Richard? I know you're a former organiser,
I got out of politics a couple of years ago.
You haven't paid your subs. Are you saying you haven't paid your subs?
Well, I found more fun things to do in life than deliver leaflets and knocking doors.
Did it coincide to becoming an irregular on this programme, I wonder?
Quite possibly.
Well, listen, Starmer has gone 2 years. What is he, the 6th, 7th, 8th in the last 10 years, Premier of Britain? He resigned this morning as UK Prime Minister. He has showed resilience, whether it's advisable or not, but obviously he's read the room here and not up for the battle with Andy Burnham.
And you know what? I think it's an absolute tragedy that Starmer has resigned. Probably not a popular opinion, but then I don't actually hold many popular opinions. I thought Starmer actually did a very solid and good job. He certainly did major steps to repair the relationships between the UK and Ireland. And Labour have achieved since 24 quite a lot in terms of workers' rights, no fault evictions, and funding for schools. But the big issue is that Starmer, I don't believe, has ever been that great a communicator. And Burnham is a good communicator, but the challenge, I think, is that Andy Burnham right now is everybody's projecting their political wish lists onto Andy Burnham, and they think that Andy is going to solve all the problems. Well,
so
I
just
think
with that in mind, that's a very interesting point, yeah. Right? So by the time he gets into the seat, it could be later in the year. There's always an election looming. So he's going to have to sit down with his advisors and say, how can I separate myself from Starmer and how can I do that blooming quickly? So what he's going to do is going to try and do stuff that seems impactful. And often, actually, that can be the popular stuff and not the right stuff to do. So what do you think he might do? And if you read it the same way, I wonder, Richard.
Yeah, I think that he's been busy painting himself into a corner, particularly over Brexit. And in the lead up where Wes Streeting, one of his main potential rivals for the Labour leadership, was making pronouncements saying that we need to take the UK back into the EU. And then Burnham immediately countered that because it wasn't politically popular. I think if I were Andy Burnham, though, I think your most power that a prime minister has is on their first day of entry into Downing Street. And after that is a massive slippery slope, because let's remember, the UK press have been pressurising Starmer to resign for some time now. As soon as Burnham walks in the door, they'd be pushing and pressurising Burnham to call a general election. And that possibly means that their friends in Reform and the Conservatives would benefit from that at the moment. And I think that that will lead to massive instability in Britain. I do believe that the British politicians pay way too much attention to the press and need to actually have the courage of their convictions. Personally, had I advised Starmer, I would have said to him to hold on and just fight back. But clearly, he has decided he's throwing in the towel this morning.
Yeah, and the others who want to get into power too outside of Labour will see blood in the water as well.
Indeed, and there's nothing like blood in the water to bring the sharks in to start having a feeding session. Mm. And I do believe that Burnham, he'll probably become Prime Minister, I should think, in September around the Labour Party conference, which means that Starmer is going to be hobbling along throughout the summer as a lame duck Prime Minister.
Yeah,
and then we will have the press going absolutely field day. Why aren't you calling a general election? Are you scared, Andy? And the pressure will be enormous. It's a similar situation that happened with Gordon Brown. Although I do believe when Brown became Prime Minister, he ought to have called a general election at that time, and he didn't.
Yes, but you'll have to set out the stall. Would I be correct in reading that Starmer is seen a bit lefty, and the powers that be that were more right within Labour are those that were backing Andy Burnham?
I think it's less of a different level of factionalism. I think Starmer, along with Morgan McSweeney, his former advisor, would have been a very close ally of Peter Mandelson. Mm. I couldn't really figure out from the life of me as to why they made Mandelson US ambassador at the time. They believed he was a Trump whisperer. But I think that, it's a high-risk strategy putting politicians into ambassadorial roles. You really need dull and boring civil servants to take care of that.
Especially
with a character like Mr. Trump.
Brilliant stuff. Richard, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk about it more into the future when we've more time. Thank you very much indeed. Former Labour Party member and did quite a bit within the Labour Party, actually, in Britain. That was a friend of the show, Richard Logue, there. That's where we leave it on the programme today. We'll be back with more, of course, bright and breezy tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Have a great day, everyone.